Hello, I'm Alan Stanford, and welcome to Macbeth in Monaghan.
When shall we three meet again? In thunder, lightning, or in rain?
Go, get him, Sir Jonathan! Long save the king! The victory fell on us!
Hooray!
What he hath lost, noble Macbeth hath won!
Like a desert needs rain, like a town needs a name, I need your love.
Look, what I have, show me!
Like a drift in its wind.
Macbeth!
Hot moon, I need your love.
That shall be king hereafter.
Stay! You are perfect speakers, tell me more!
I need your love.
What? Can the devil speak true?
Come, you spirits, attend on mortal thoughts.
Duncan comes here tonight.
Like a rhythm unbroken, like drums in the night.
Huh?
Like sweet soul music, like sunlight. Need your love.
Bring forth men shall blow me.
I'm coming home, and you don't know where you've been.
This is a sunny sight.
Like nicotine, I need your love.
Macbeth does murder sleep! Macbeth! Shall sleep the more!
A little water clears us of this deed.
Wake Duncan with thy knocking!
Hello and welcome again to St. Louis Secondary School, Carrick Macross in County Monaghan for the fourth and final programme of our series Macbeth in Monaghan. Pupils from Monaghan Collegiate School, Patrician High School and St. McCartan's College will join us again for this, our final programme. This last programme deals to a large extent with the final act of the play, with Act 5, which is the revenge. We've already seen through the previous programmes the gradual descent into chaos. We had the prophecy. We had the murder, we had the betrayal, and we've had the genocide. And it's almost like a great wheel moving down a hill. Scotland descends slowly into chaos because of one man's ambition. But we mustn't forget at any point that it's a man, not a monster. It's not some wild animal. It's a human being with human frailty. A man who could have been a hero, was a national hero, but who became corrupted because of his own ambition and because of the temptations that fate put in his way. The witches, the weird sisters, are like, in Greek tragedy, the fates. They are the option you could take. They have said, this will happen. This is the future. And the temptation of that future destroys Macbeth. And with him, the country that he is meant to govern. He has brought it to its knees. He has really destroyed it by his own ambition. However, the night is long that never finds the day, says Malcolm, and Malcolm is coming. High up on his castle in Dunsinane, Macbeth the tyrant waits, but Malcolm and his army are approaching.
The English power is near, led on by Malcolm, his uncle Siward, and the good Macduff.
Revenge is born in them, for their dear causes would to the bleeding and grim alarm excite the mortified man.
Near Benham Wood shall we well meet them. That way are they coming.
What does the tyrant?
Great Dunsinane he strongly fortifies.
Some say he's mad.
Others that lesser hate him, they call it valiant fury.
But for certain, he cannot buckle his distempered cause within the belt of rule.
Now does he feel his secret mortar sticking on his hands.
Those he commands move only in command, nothing in love.
Now does he feel his title hang loose about him, like a giant's robe upon a dwarfish teeth.
Who then shall blame his passive senses to recoil and start, when all that is within him does condemn itself for being there?
Well, march we on to give obedience where it is truly owed.
Meet we the medicine of the sickly wheel.
And with him pour we in our country's purge each drop of us.
Make we our march towards Burnham.
So waiting in the wings, or at least in the forest, is the avenging hero. And thank you to Jonathan Williams, Sean Carolan, Patrick Moyner, Dara Hamill and Daryl Caplice for reading in those parts.
My name is Liam O'Shaughnessy. I'm a student in St. Coleman's Community College in Middleton. I'm going to read a quote by Macbeth from Act 5, Scene 5. I begin to doubt the equivocation of the fiend that lies like truth. Fear not, till Burnham Wood do come to Dunsinane, and now a wood comes to Dunsinane. Arm, arm, and doubt, if this which ye avouges does appear. There is not flying hence, nor tarrying here. I begin to be aweary of the sun, and wish the estate of the world were now undone. Ring the alarm bell, blow wind, come rack, at least we'll die with harness on our back. This piece is very significant in relation to the changes in the character of Macbeth we see. The Macbeth from earlier in the play, who blindly believed the prophecies of the witches, begins to gain some sense. He realises that he has been tricked. Macbeth sees the witches for what they are, fiends. We also see Macbeth become somewhat of his old self. The brave soldier that Macbeth is begins to re-emerge. I like Macbeth's resolution to keep fighting until the end, when he realises that all hope of survival is lost.
My name is Miriam Pepper and I'm a sixth-year student in San Sabina Sutton. In my opinion, the theme of kingship is a very important theme in the play Macbeth. At the time of the play's original writing and staging, kings were seen as God's representatives on earth. Therefore, the killing of a king and the subsequent abuse of the office of king, when presented in a dramatic form, would have astounded an audience. The play concerns four kings: Duncan, Macbeth, Malcolm, Edward the Confessor, and their contrasting reigns. Duncan is a noble, kind, and generous king. He is loved by the people. He deals with political unrest swiftly, yet he is naive. He fails to recognise traitors in both Cawdor and Macbeth. Malcolm does not wish to follow in his father's footsteps on this issue. He tests Macduff in Act 4, Scene 3, saying he possesses none of the kingly graces which render him unworthy of succession. This shows political tact on his part. Malcolm demonstrates good leadership in the advance on Dunsinane and rewards those loyal to him by creating earls, showing kingly benevolence. Macbeth is the nadir of the office of kingship. He is a tyrant, he abuses his power, a murderer of friends and innocent children when on the throne, evil, corrupt, placing his faith in the dark arts. He is unworthy of the throne and knows it, speaking of it as fruitless. His title is described by Angus as hanging loose about him like a giant's robe on a dwarfish thief. Edward the Confessor is the best king whose office is dealt with in the play. Though never seen, he is described as pious and holy. He believes Scotland can be cured by prayer, but his decision to send Old Seward and 10,000 men to assist Malcolm and Macduff shows great diplomatic sense. Therefore, it is clear that kingship is an important theme in the play, and the various styles of kingship contrast sharply with each other.
I'm Vincent Murphy, I'm in De La Salle College in Waterford. I found that one of the first scenes with the witches, the actual very first scene, was quite good because it immediately set out the dark implications that the play was to have, and it set the tone for the entire play. You know, there's a deep, dark undercurrent underneath everything that happened. And the witches, I think, were the most important because they sort of affected what all the characters did. They manipulated Macbeth. If they hadn't said what they said, then Macbeth wouldn't have done anything. So I think the blame and responsibility of Macbeth's actions lays with them. Fair is foul and foul is fair, however, through the fog and filthy air. I know it's kind of stupid, but I like the way that it kind of set out that the witches are dark and they're evil, and from the start that even though it's kind of the quintessential witches chant, that it sets you up that that's what they're going to be about. They're going to be manipulating and they're going to be using the characters for their own enjoyment, and it's just a game to them.
So Shakespeare now sets up a situation where you have Macbeth in his castle, Malcolm outside. In other words, a siege situation. Malcolm is going to attack the castle at Dunsinane, the one place in the world that Macbeth feels safe. Why? Because the witches told him he is perfectly safe and he cannot be overcome till Burnham Forest come to Dunsinane. So that's where he knows he's safe. He feels secure and he is very, very confident.
Bring me no more reports. Let them fly all. Till Burnham Wood removed to Dunstan and I cannot taint with fear. What's the boy, Malcolm? Was he not born of woman? The spirits that know all mortal consequences have pronounced me thus. Fear not, Macbeth. No man that's born of woman shall ever have power upon thee. Then fly, false Danes, and mingle with the English epicures. The mind I sway by and the heart I bear shall never sag with doubt nor shake with fear.
He sounds incredibly confident. But the growing news of Malcolm's arrival does seem to worry him a little. Macbeth himself has reached a strange kind of plateau where he seems to have lost all fear, but he's also becoming very conscious of the reality of what he himself is. It's as though a kind of despair and a loneliness is creeping into him, a realization that he's not the man that he once dreamed he would be. News comes of the approaching army.
The devil damn thee back, thou cream-faced loon. Where's got thou that goose luck?
There is 10,000.
Geese, villain?
Soldier, so.
Death of thy soul, those linen cheeks of thine are counsellors to fear. What soldiers, wayface?
The English force, so please you.
Take thy face hence. Seaton, I am sick at heart, while I behold. Seaton, I say, this push will cheer me ever, or deceit me now.
This push will cheer me ever, or deceit me now. This is it. This is the be-all and the end-all. This is the moment that will decide his future.
I have lived long enough. My way of life is fallen into the sear, the yellow leaf.
In other words, he's admitting that he's actually beginning to come towards a possible end.
And that which should accompany old age, as honour, love, obedience, troops of friends, I must not look to have, but in their stead, curses, not loud but deep, mouth honour, breath, which the poor heart would fain deny and dare not. Seaton!
And what he's saying here is that he has realized that all around him are nothing but sycophants, people who will praise him because they're afraid of him. No true friends left. He will not look forward to a happy retirement. There is no happy retirement for someone like Macbeth. All he has is people cursing him behind his back. Not loud curses, but very deep. People paying mouth honor, saying, yes, your majesty, no, your majesty, but not really meaning it. And too afraid to admit it. Then more news comes.
What news more?
All is confirmed, my lord, which was reported.
I'll fight till from my bones my flesh be hacked. Give me mine armour.
'Tis not needed yet.
I'll put it on. Send out more horses. Scare the country round. Hang those that talk of fear. Give me mine armour.
It's strange that at this moment he probably shows more courage than at any other time in the play since the very beginning when he killed Macdonald. Here he is under siege, an army of 10,000 soldiers outside his castle. But he shows no fear. I'll put my armor on. I'm going to fight. Yes, he's confident that he himself cannot be killed. Yes, he's confident that he cannot be overcome. But it's still a daunting prospect, and it does show an incredible amount of courage. And thank you to David O'Hagan as Macbeth, Kieran Smith as the servant, and Ronan Lennon as Seaton in that sequence.
I'm Mark Patrick Hederman from Glenstall Abbey, and I'm talking to you about free will in the tragedy of Macbeth. The whole play of Macbeth concerns whether or not Macbeth was free to do what he did and to become what he became, King of Scotland, and later on then to have committed the murders that he did commit, and whether or not this was his own doing or whether he was forced to do it by powers outside his control represented by the witches. The witches made promises to him such as that he would not be killed by any person except somebody who wasn't actually of woman born, and that nothing would happen to him, he would never be conquered till Birnam Wood removed to Dunsinane. Now, he believed that those things couldn't possibly happen, and therefore he was perfectly free to carry on his particular career, and that he would be protected by these powers. Now, in the end of the play, obviously, he is shown that this was a trick. The enemy used the unusual ploy of cutting down great branches from Birnam Wood to camouflage themselves so that the lookout in his castle think that Birnam Wood is moving to Dunsinane. And also he discovers that Macduff was from his mother's womb untimely ripped, so that therefore he has been tricked doubly by the witches. Now, he himself at that moment, Macbeth, reveals himself to be a very brave and almost pitiable person, because instead of cringing and falling into despair, he says, no, let's go to the end. Lay on, Macduff, and damned be him that first cries, hold enough.
More bad news is coming concerning the health of his wife.
How does your patient, doctor?
Not so sick, my lord, as she is troubled with take coming fancies that keep her from her rest.
Cure her of that. Canst thou not minister to a mind diseased? pluck from the memory of a rooted sorrow, raise out the written troubles of the brain, and with some sweet oblivious antidote, cleanse the stuffed bosom of the perilous stuff, which weighs upon the heart.
Therein the patient must minister to himself.
Throw physic to the dogs, I'll none of it. Come, put mine armour on, give me my staff. Seaton, send out. Doctor, the thanes fly from me.
Doctor, the thanes fly from me. It's the only little indication we get, but what he's saying is, even the people who are supporting him in the castle are beginning to run away. He's beginning to be left alone.
Come, sir, dispatch. If thou couldest, doctor, cast the water of my land, find her disease, and purge it to a sound and pristine health. I would applaud thee to the very echo that should applaud again.
What he's doing here, in a strange way, is comparing Scotland and his wife. He's saying, you can't cure my wife. He's saying, I can't cure Scotland. I wish you could. I wish you could make it all better. It's that cry from the heart that says, I've made a terrible mess of everything. I wish somebody could put it right, but nobody can.
Pull it off, I say. What rhubarb, thyme, or what purgative drug would scare these English hence? Bring it after me. I will not be afraid of death and bane till Burnham Forest comes to Dunstan.
Still that belief that he is perfectly safe till Burnham Forest come to Dunsinane. And thank you to Michael Hanratty as the Doctor and David O'Hagan from Macbeth, both from Patrician. Thank you.
My name is Anna Lynch. I'm a teacher in Inver College, and I'm going to outline how to structure an answer on Lady Macbeth. It's important that all students would begin by underlining the keywords in the question that they have been given. Next, they must begin to plan their question, beginning with a thesis statement which restates the task that has been assigned to them. Brainstorm the thesis, dividing it into numbers of related issues. Each of these issues will in turn become a paragraph in their essay. Link the text and or performance to each issue in each paragraph. Make a firm decision in the concluding paragraph with regard to the opening thesis. Avoid sitting on the fence at this point, as the examiner will be looking for a definite answer. Restate the opening thesis afresh. An example answer is, in her final scenes, Lady Macbeth is isolated in her suffering and demented state. How did she change from my dearest partner of greatness to a queen whose death is not mourned? She should have died hereafter. Lady Macbeth first appears in Act 1, Scene 5. She reads a letter that has been sent to her by her husband, informing her of the weird sisters and their prophecies. Instantly, Lady Macbeth decides which course of action she must take. She asks the spirits to unsex me here, fill her with the cruelty necessary to carry out her plan. Macbeth enters and addresses his wife as my dearest love. This is our first indication of the bond that exists between these two. They are both singing from the same hymn sheet with regard to Duncan's murder and their accession to the throne of Scotland. As Macbeth begins to waver in Act 1, Scene 7, students should note how steadfast Lady Macbeth is in her role. Having just witnessed the intimacy and confidence in this relationship, we now see that he expects guidance and inspiration from her also. She is his strength. She knows her husband well. As Macbeth cowers and says, "We will proceed no further in this business," Lady Macbeth remains focused. She accuses her husband of being unmanly, saying she would have killed her own baby if she had sworn to do so, rather than go back on her word. While this statement from Lady Macbeth may give rise to universal hatred due to its travesty of the Madonna ideal, it is important to remember at this point that she knows what is required to inspire her dithering husband, and she will go to any lengths to deliver it. Lady Macbeth's sense of determination is to the fore at this point. As we watch the murder plan unfold, we soon realise that Lady Macbeth is not the most intelligent of women. She may be determined, cold and calculated, but her plan for Duncan's murder is a simple one. As she prepares the murder scene, we glimpse the sentimental side of Lady Macbeth. She is unable to kill Duncan as he looks too like her father. Perhaps this is the side of his wife that Macbeth has never seen. Act 2, Scene 2 informs us that Lady Macbeth has drunk some of the alcohol with which she plied the guards, thus disclosing her nervous disposition at this point. We also witness that she regains her composure when Macbeth returns and his blunder is noted. She has the ability to mask her true thoughts and feelings in an instant, perhaps an indication of her Machiavellian nature. Unfortunately, as she advises her husband post-murder, consider it not so deeply, we also realise that she did not think beyond the action to the consequences of their crime. It is highly ironic that she says, these deeds must not be thought after these ways, so it will make us mad. At this point, she is determined that sentiment and fear will not take hold of her. It is quite possible that at this point she is suppressing her true nature so that her husband may achieve his ambition to be king. Such suppression can only be short-lived. Although she corrects matters at the murder scene and callously says that a little water clears us of this deed, we know that her blood-stained hands will haunt her and drive her to her death. Also, she wanted the murder of Duncan to be carried out under the cover of darkness, giving witness to the fact that she is not without conscience, she merely suppresses it. Following on from this, students should deal with the banquet scene in detail and Lady Macbeth's fainting. A student might want to consider whether this is a real or artificial faint. After this incident, never again do we witness the steely resolve of previous scenes. Rather, we observe her gradual isolation, breakdown and suicide. Despite wallowing in her own guilt at this stage, she never shares it with her husband, nor does she show any weakness in his presence. She still supports Macbeth, who is oblivious to her deterioration. His role never seems to be to support her. She is no longer his trusted confidant. Undoubtedly, it is guilt and remorse that ultimately destroy Lady Macbeth. She is absent from Act 4, thus indicating her discarded status. Her function is complete. Her husband has abandoned her for a world of darkness, witches, and a campaign of terror.
Theatrically, Shakespeare keeps jumping from the castle out to the battlefield, or rather, to the woods, to keep that relentless pressure, the pressure of Malcolm's approach. No matter what's happening to Macbeth inside the castle, no matter what he's thinking, outside, Malcolm is approaching. That big army is getting closer and closer and closer. And out in the forest, Malcolm has a very clever idea.
What wood is this before us?
The wood of Birnam.
Let every soldier hew him down a bough and bear it before him. Thereby shall we shadow the numbers of our host and make discovery, ere in report of us.
We learn no other but the confident tyrant keeps still in Dunsinane and will endure our setting down before it.
This is main hope.
The time approaches that will with due decision make us know what we shall say we have and what we owe.
Malcolm has decided to move Birnam Wood to Dunsinane. Thank you there to Daryl, to Dara, to Sean and to Patrick, all from Patrician for reading that. Thank you.
Flanagan, and I'm a sixth-year student attending Loretto College, St. Stephen's Green. I'm going to discuss my favourite scene, which is in Act 1, Scene 5, where we can clearly see the dark and evil side to Lady Macbeth. Lady Macbeth has just received a letter from Macbeth telling her that he has been given the title Thane of Corder. She feels that, although ambitious, her husband lacks the ruthlessness necessary if he is to realise his ambition of becoming king. Lady Macbeth is determined to remove all obstacles that could prevent this from happening. She's so determined to make her husband king that she barters her feminine nature and her humanity. Come, you spirits that tend on mortal thoughts, unsex me here and fill me, from the crown to the toe, top full of direst cruelty. Make thick my blood, stop up the access and passage to remorse, that no compunctions, visitings of nature shake my fell purpose, nor keep peace between the effect and it. Come to my woman's breasts and take my milk for gall, you murdering ministers. Wherever in your sightless substances you wait on nature's mischief, come thick night and pall thee in the dunnest smoke of hell, that my keen knife see not the wound it makes, nor heaven peep through the blanket of the dark. All obstacles must give way. There must be no element of conscience or pity to prevent her achieving her goal. She is total in her commitment. Lady Macbeth shows her pure evilness by wanting to eliminate all of her human qualities. She has become a fourth witch. Lady Macbeth states at the end that she doesn't even want heaven to witness the terrible actions that she has in mind. I think this scene is the most chilling and evil scene of the play. Lady Macbeth has lost all sense of decency, conscience, and scruples. We can see in this scene how single-minded she is and that she is willing to do absolutely anything to gain her power.
My name is Brian O'Reilly. I am a student at St. Colman's Community College, Middleton. In the following piece, from Act 5, Scene 5, We hear Macbeth's response to the news that his wife is dead. She should have died hereafter. There would have been a time for such a word. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in the petty time from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time. And all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage, and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. He knows that his wife had to die at some point, but due to his current predicament he finds the news of her death to be little more of an inconvenience. Had she died at a later date, he might have had time to mourn, but at this moment in time, her death only serves to remind him of the great futility of life, that we must all play out our parts on the stage of the world. Macbeth's ruthless ambition has turned him from the loving character we see at the beginning of the play into a person so cold and detached from life that his own wife's death is a mere annoyance.
I'm Grace Heffron, I'm in Newtown School, sixth year. And the character would have to be Macbeth in the banquet scene when he sees the ghost of Banquo in the dining room. I think it'll be good in a play whether they put it in as Banquo is real and he's a person, or it's all in Macbeth's imagination. Lady Macbeth is just like covering for Macbeth, and she's trying to just say that, you know, he is sane and he's just having a bad day.
Back up in the castle, Macbeth is demonstrating yet again his courage.
Hang out our banners on the outward walls. The cry is still, they come. Our castle's strength will laugh a siege to scorn. Here, let them lie, till famine and the ague eat them up. Were they not forced with those that should be ours? We might have met them dareful, beard to beard, and beat them backward home.
The reason he's sitting in that castle is not because he's afraid, but because he simply hasn't enough soldiers left to go out and fight a battle. He wants to do it. He wants to fight them. He wants to beat Malcolm out of the country. But he can't, because everyone is deserting him. And then, finally, the worst news for him.
The Queen, my lord, is dead.
She should have died hereafter. There would have been a time for such a word. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time, and all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing.
It's almost as though at this point Macbeth has begun to realise the absolute futility of his situation, the waste of his life. Life itself has been reduced in his mind to a poor player strutting and fretting his time upon the stage, a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury and meaning nothing. The whole of his life has been full of sound and fury. He's been a warrior, a king, a tyrant, and a genocidal megalomaniac. And all of that, at the end of the day, is brought down to nothing. His wife is dead. He is under siege. Everything has become almost meaningless. The only thing he's got left to do now is to fight. And now, at his lowest point, at the point when he is probably more depressed than at any other time in the play, there really does come news to cause fear in his soul and in his imagination. The prophecy returns to haunt him.
Gracious my lord, I should report that which I say I saw, but know not how to do it.
Well, say so.
As I did stand my watch upon the hill, I looked toward Burnham, and anon, methought, the wood began to move.
Liar and slave, if thou speakest false, upon the next tree thou shalt hang alive, till famine cling thee. If thy speech be sooth, I care not if thou dost for me as much. I pull in resolution, and begin to doubt the equivocation of the fiend that lies like truth. Fear not, till Burnham Wood do come to Dunsinane. And now a wood comes toward Dunsinane. Arm, arm, and out. If this which he avouches does appear, there is nor flying hence, nor tarrying here. I begin to be wary of the sun, and wish the estate o'er the world were now undone. Ring the alarming bell. Blow wind, come rack. At least we'll die with harness on our back.
And within this speech, everything seems to come together, finally. Burnham Wood is coming to Dunsinane. The prophecy is being fulfilled. It told him not to fear until Burnham Wood comes to Dunsinane. He made the assumption that it never would, but the prophecy told the truth. Now he fears the equivocation of the fiend. The fiend tells lies by telling the truth, deceives you with the truth, and Burnham Forrest comes to Dunsinane. But he doesn't turn into a coward at this moment. He doesn't run away. His reaction is quite immediate and is the reaction of the hero that he once was. Arm, and out. He had decided to fight the battle by staying within the castle and letting them besiege him. Now he knows, even though Burnham Wood is coming to Dunsinane, he will have to go out into the field and fight them in a conventional battle. He has to go out alone, if necessary, to fight them. I begin to be aweary of the sun. If we remember in the earlier stages of the play, he was constantly calling on the darkness, calling darkness down. Stars, hide your fires. Come, sealing night. All the time he wanted darkness, but he's been exposed to the sun. And Shakespeare here is using a double image as well, because it's not just the sun, S-U-N, but the sun, S-O-N, the son of Duncan. That's the blazing light that's coming to burn him. He's getting tired of it. He wants an end to it. But he wants to die the way he should, as a warrior, as a hero, with harness on his back. Thank you there to Michal and to David and to Ronan from Patrician for reading that scene.
My name is Niamh Farrell, and I'm a sixth-year student in St. Sabina, Sutton. In my opinion, one of the most disturbing and pivotal quotes in Macbeth is spoken by Lady Macbeth in the first act. The quote itself is straightforward, and in ways I think this adds to the impact of the statement. Sometimes the lines in Macbeth are difficult to understand, but this is obviously dark, disturbing, and evil. She says, "Come, ye spirits that tend on mortal thoughts, unsex me here and fill me from crown to toe, top full of direst cruelty. Make thick my blood, stop up the access and passage to remorse." The imagery in these lines really impacted on me because it is so full of blood, a motif that reoccurs constantly throughout Macbeth. The lines are powerful, tenacious, and evil. The lines, "Come to my woman's breasts and take my milk for gall," are shockingly inhumane. It's a disturbing concept for a human being to ask evil spirits to deny her femininity and to destroy her natural empathy and remorse. The language is also very effective at emphasising the darkness, and words like night, smoke of hell, and murdering ministers added to the chilling atmosphere. It is definitely a clear reminder that evil cannot be manipulated, and the events that follow show that trying to control it has terrible consequences.
My name is Shane Gibbons, and I am a six-year student from Belvedere College, and my favourite quote from Macbeth is, "I have no spirit to prick the sides of my intent, but only vaulting ambition which overleaps itself and falls onto the other." This is my favourite quote from Macbeth, because it emphasised Macbeth's motives for killing Duncan. It is also a wonderful, unique metaphor. What Macbeth is saying is that were it not for his relentless ambition, he would have no incentive to commit regicide. Without this, he is a good man, but with this overruling flaw, he has become a villain. Shakespeare compares Macbeth's ambition to an over-eager rider. Macbeth's conscience is the rider in place in the horse, but the thought of becoming king forces his ambition to push the conscience of the horse, leaving his conscience off the horse, with the ambition taking control.
Hi, my name is Hazel Quinn, and I'm a six-year student in Loretto College, St. Stephen's Green, and my favourite character is Macbeth and how he's displayed as a tragic hero. In Macbeth, Shakespeare has created a tragic hero out of a brutal murderer. He is indeed a man driven by ruthless ambition, but also to some extent tortured by regret. By giving Macbeth a sensitive conscience, Shakespeare endows him with a certain nobility. Macbeth, the play, is in essence a portrait of one man's destruction of his own spirit. In the beginning of the play, Macbeth is overshadowed by Lady Macbeth. She is seen as the one with more control. Once she hears about the prophecy, she takes action and decides they are going to murder Duncan. She informs her husband how to act to hide his true feelings. Look like the innocent flower would be the serpent under it. The witch's prophecy stirs Macbeth's ambition, but what drives him to become even more powerful is, in fact, Lady Macbeth. She challenges his masculinity in order to manipulate him to commit murders. When you durst do it, then you are a man. Swayed by the sheer force of her eloquence, the wavering Macbeth is dominated. Although, once the first murder is committed, Macbeth gains some confidence and grows stronger. As he's gaining this strength, he feels there's no real need for his wife in his plans, and Lady Macbeth grows weaker as a result of this. Her initial courage and daring didn't last long, and she quickly deteriorates into a delusional, hapless somnambulist. As the list of murders expands from Duncan to Banquo, to Lady Macduff and her children, we see how Macbeth falls deeper and deeper into wickedness. The banquet scene marks Macbeth's final confrontation with conscience. This manifests itself in the form of Banquo's ghosts. When he is finally able to banish this apparition from his sight, he finally becomes an openly ruthless tyrant. He is completely consumed by evil, and murder is now without any concealment. There are also reports of how Scotland is suffering under Macbeth's reign of terror. Just as Macbeth had been in turmoil inside his own mind, this turmoil has spread throughout Scotland like a disease. By the final act of the play, rather than regret, there is a sense of recognition in Macbeth, and he appears to acknowledge how empty and futile his existence appears now. How life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and is heard no more. A hero is someone of exceptional courage and strength. A tragic hero is defined as someone of high class who possesses a character flaw, which eventually causes their downfall and other downfalls in society. In Shakespeare's Macbeth, Macbeth's ambition possesses him to kill innocent people. Macbeth's ambition and actions both badly affect the nation of Scotland, therefore proving Macbeth is an example of a Shakespearean tragic hero.
Malcolm has arrived. No more pretense, no more hiding behind trees. Now they're ready for the battle.
Now, near enough, your leafy screens throw down and show like those you are.
Do we but find the tyrant's power tonight? Let us be beaten if we cannot fight.
Make all our trumpets speak, give them all breath, those clamorous harbingers of blood and death.
The battle has begun. Macbeth is fighting his way through impossible odds, but he does it with that certainty that no matter what else may happen, they may take his crown, they may take his country, but they cannot take his life. He has a charmed life.
They have tied me to a stake. I cannot fly, but bear-like I must fight the course. What's he that was not born of woman? Such a one I am to fear, or none.
What is thy name?
Thou'st be afraid to hear it.
No, though thou callest thyself a hotter name than any is in hell.
My name is Macbeth.
And immediately he turns and kills young Siward, without a second thought.
Thou wast born of woman, but swords I smile at. Let weapons laugh to scorn, brandished by a man that's of woman born. Why should I play the Roman fool and die on my own sword? While I see lives, the gashes do better upon them.
And that's the warrior speaking. I'm not going to kill myself. I'm not going to end it all. I'll kill anyone who comes near me. He's fighting with tremendous courage, but again, with that certainty that he is invulnerable. But now he must face his nemesis. Now he must face his final fear. Now he's got to meet the doom that the weird sisters and the apparitions foretold. Remember, they always told the truth. It must come to pass. And he finally meets Macduff. That same Macduff, prowling round the battlefield, is trying to find Macbeth.
That way the noise is, tyrant. Show thy face. If thou be slain with no stroke of mine, my wife and children's ghosts will haunt me still. I cannot strike at wretched kerns, whose arms are hired to bear their staves. Either thou, Macbeth, or else my sword, with unbattered edged, I sheathe undeeded. Let me find him, fortune, and more I beg not.
What he's saying is he doesn't want to fight anybody else. He'll go through the entire battle. He won't fight another soul. There's only one person he wants, and that's Macbeth. Then he finds him.
Turn, hellhound, turn.
Of all men else I have avoided thee, but get thee back. My soul is too much charged with blood of thine already.
I have no words. My voice is in my sword, thou bloodier villain, than terms can give thee out.
Already Macbeth is saying, I don't want to hurt you. I don't want to kill you. I've done enough. The guilt, the pressure of what he's done is building up in him. He just doesn't want any more. But they fight.
Thou losest labor, as easy make the entrenchant air with thy keen sword and press as make me bleed. Let fall the blade on vulnerable crests. I bear a charmed life, which must not yield to one of woman born.
And it's strange, at that moment he is saying to Macduff, you can't kill me, and I don't want to kill you. But he's got to find something out.
Despair thy charm, and let the angel whom thou still hast served tell thee Macduff was from his mother's womb untimely ripped.
And there you have it. There's the simple way that Macbeth was deceived. Macduff was not born from his mother. He was taken out of her womb by a caesarean operation. Ripped from his mother's womb, not born. The fiend told the truth, but Macbeth didn't understand it. And now he knows he's going to die.
Accursed be the tongue that tells me so, for it had cowed my better part of man. And be these juggling fiends no more believed, that palter with us in a double sense, that keep the word of promise in it to our ear, and break it to our hope. I'll not fight with thee.
Then yield thee, coward, and live to be the show of the gaze of the time. We'll have thee, as our rarer monsters are, painted on a pole and under writ. Hear me, you see the tyrant.
I will not yield, to kiss the ground before young Malcolm's feet, and to be baited with the rabble's curse. Though burning wood be come to Dunstanane, and thou opposed, being of no woman born, yet I will try the last. Before my body I throw my warlike shield. Lay on, Macduff, and damn be him that first cries, hold, enough.
And that's the final act of courage. He knows he's going to die. He knows that Macduff is the man who will kill him. But right at the end, still, he says, I'm going to die fighting. It's that last act of courage from the warrior and hero that we began the play with, finally breaking through and saying, I'm going to die like a man. I'm not a monster. I am a man, and I'll die like one. Lay on, Macduff, and curse be him that first cries, hold enough, is the cry of a hero. And thank you to Sean, to David, to Daryl, to Paul, and to Patrick from Patrician for reading that sequence.
My name is Terry Coffey. I am a teacher at St. Nessens Community College here in Limerick. The question that I want to have a look at today is a question on the theme of deception. It is crucial in any question that you're doing on paper to plan your answer very carefully before you start to write. I would begin by looking at the word deception itself and maybe jot down in your margin a number of different ways of saying deception. For example, equivocation, the difference between what is real and imagined, illusion and apparition. This will avoid repetition of the same word throughout your answer. Next, I would write down all the main ideas that I feel should be discussed in my answer. First of all, Duncan's misplaced trust, the trust that he placed in Cawdor, and the trust that he placed in Macbeth and Lady Macbeth. Things in this play are rarely what they seem. Second of all, I would look at how Lady Macbeth and Macbeth deceive themselves. Third of all, I would look at how the witches deceive Macbeth and ask the question, which is probably the central question in the play, do they actually deceive Macbeth, or does Macbeth deceive himself in over-relying on their prophecies? So those three headings will form the basis or the core of my answer. Next, I would go through each of the main points that I have planned out and make sure that I have some references and quotations from the play to back them up. Our first point will be how Duncan is so easily deceived by the Thane of Cawdor and later by Macbeth and Lady Macbeth. Duncan is guilty of misplaced trust. He says, after the execution of Cawdor, there's no art to find the mind's construction in the face. He was a man on whom I'd built an absolute trust. On entering Macbeth's castle, this castle hath a pleasant seat, the air nimbly and sweetly recommends itself unto our gentle senses. Lady Macbeth says, he that's coming must be provided for. She warns her husband, look like the innocent flower, but be the serpent under it. Macbeth declares that false face must hide what the false heart doth know. Following the murder, in his false outrage, he declares his silver skin laced with his golden blood. Banquo announces that he fights of treasonous malice. Throughout the opening scene of the play, it is very clear that deception and lack of trust is going to form a major part of it. When we've looked at how Duncan is deceived, it's important to note that unlike Duncan, his sons Malcolm and Donalbain are very slow to put their trust in anyone. And this is why he says there's daggers in men's smiles. That would form the basis of your opening paragraph. In paragraph 2, move on and look at the idea of self-deception and how Lady Macbeth and Macbeth are both guilty of same. Again, I would look through and revise some of the quotes that would help me to back up this answer. When Lady Macbeth says, a little water clears us of this deed, she says, consider it not so deeply. These deeds must not be thought of after these ways, so it will make us mad. And ironically, all of these things come back to haunt her towards the end of the play. She deceives herself into thinking that she can stop up the access and passage to remorse. She wishes that her keen knife see not the wound it makes. Clearly she is deceiving herself when we see her in the sleepwalking scenes, now haunted by the very blood that she thought she could get rid of. Macbeth, like Lady Macbeth, allows the witches to guide his life. He places all his trust on the same supernatural soliciting as his wife. As a result, he clings to their predictions. He bears a charmed life which must not yield to one of woman born. It is only when the messenger announces that the forest is moving towards Dunsinane does he suspect, finally, the equivocation of a fiend. Macbeth also deceives himself throughout the play. Examples of this would have been the appearance of the dagger, the appearance of the ghost at the banquet scene, the apparitions, and of course the witch's prophecies. He tells himself, "Thou art a dagger of the mind, a false creation." Banquo, ironically, warns him after they meet the witches, "Beware the instrument of darkness. They win us with honest trifles to betray us in the deepest consequence." Foolishly, he thinks he can control them. Now that you've looked at how Macbeth and Lady Macbeth deceive themselves, it is important to ask the question, do the witches deceive Macbeth? Or is it Macbeth's self-deception that brings about his downfall? Is he deceived by the equivocating fiends? Macbeth interprets the witch's prophecies literally. The forest moves to Dunsinane on Malcolm's orders. The armed head on the battlements turns out to be Macbeth's own. The eight kings turn out to be Banquo's dynasty. So one has to ask themselves, was the truth there all the time? Every one of the witches' prophecies did come true. Who was deceiving whom? Did Macbeth deceive himself? Or do you still believe it was the witches' deception? We then move on to our conclusion. The pattern that most essays should form would be, say what you're going to say, say it, and then say what you've said. So in the conclusion, reiterate how deception has played an important role throughout the play. Deception also adds to the dramatic irony of the play. Not just the characters are surprised at the truth of the witch's revelations, so too are the audience, as they see Birnam Wood about to move towards Dunsinane. Macbeth is the most deceived character in the play. He believed his own eyes and ears. He put his faith in the powers of darkness. And this brings about his ultimate downfall.
Macbeth, finally, is dead. The genocide is over. The tyranny is over. His vaunting ambition blinded him to the truth and brought him to his end. And Malcolm is declared king.
Hail, king, for so thou art. Behold where stands the usurper's cursed head. The time is free. I see thee compassed with thy kingdom's pearl, that speak my salutation in their minds, whose voices I desire aloud with mine. Hail, King of Scotland!
Hail, King of Scotland!
Malcolm, who represents the future and the cleansing of the past. Always, a new order will come to sweep away the old. Civilization returns, and the natural order is again in place. Of course, assuming that another despot doesn't come along. And thank you to Sean, Raymond, Daryl, Patrick, Jonathan, David, Michal, and Michael, all from Patrician. Thank you. And in today's quiz, representing St. Louis, we have
Karen Harrigan.
From Patrician, we have
Sean Carlin.
From Collegiate,
Valer Fanny Kirk.
And from St. McCartan's,
Kieran Hendry.
Now, we're going to begin with a question for each of you. Karen, who says, "Some holy angel fly to the court of England and unfold his message ere he come, that a swift blessing may soon return to this our suffering country, under a hand accursed"?
Lennox.
Well done. That's 2 points. Sean, who says, "Here's the smell of the blood still. All the perfumes of Arabia will not sweeten this little hand"?
Lady Macbeth.
Correct. 2 points. Villep, who says, "Now does he feel his title hang loose about him, like a giant's robe upon a dwarfish thief"?
Caithness.
Well done. Tricky one. And Kieran. Who says life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more?
Macbeth.
Macbeth is right. 2 points each. Well done. Round two is our recorded round. I want you each to listen to your particularly recorded piece and tell me who's speaking to who in it. First of all, Karen, this is yours.
Duncan comes here tonight.
And when goes hence?
Tomorrow, as he purposes.
Oh, never shall sun that morrow see.
Now, who is speaking there?
Macbeth, Lady Macbeth.
Well done, 2 points. Sean, here's yours.
I'll to England, to Ireland I. Our separated fortune shall keep us both the safer. Where we are, there's daggers in men's smiles. The near in blood, the nearer bloody.
This murderous shaft that shot had not yet lighted. And our safest way is to avoid the aim.
Malcolm is speaking to Donald Bain.
Correct. Villa, here's yours.
How came she by that light?
Why, it stood by her. She has light by her continually. 'Tis her command.
You see, her eyes are open.
Aye, but their sense is shut.
What is it she does now? Look how she rubs her hands.
It is an accustomed action with her to seem thus washing her hands. I have known her continue in this a quarter of an hour.
It's a doctor to the gentlewoman.
Well done, Lily, that's correct. 2 points. And finally, Kieran, here's yours.
I see thee compassed with thy kingdom's pearl that speak my salutation in their minds, whose voices I desire aloud with mine. Hail, King of Scotland!
Hail, King of Scotland!
We shall not spend a large expense of time before we reckon with our several loves and make us even with you.
Who's speaking there?
Is it Macduff speaking to Malcolm?
It is indeed. Well done. 2 points. And we're at level pegging here. 4 points for each team. So we go on to the round of quickfire questions. Now, fingers on buzzers. Here we go. Who leads the English army? And that is Sean.
Malcolm, Seward and Macduff.
Well done. That's correct. All three are right. When Macbeth hears that Macduff is fled to England, he goes to Fife. Why?
To kill Macduff's wife and children.
That's correct. Who tells Macduff of his family's... that's Villa?
Ross.
Ross is correct. In Act 5 of the play, Lady Macbeth is suffering from a nocturnal ailment. What is it? That was Sean.
Somnambulism. Sleepwalking.
Sleepwalking. Well done, yes. What is Lady Macbeth trying to do when she imagines she's washing her hands?
She's trying to wash the blood off her hands.
Trying to clean the blood from them. Well done. Where's the English army going? That is Villa.
Burnham Wood.
To Burnham Wood, correct. A lot of strange characters in this one. Angus, Caithness, Monteith, Lennox. Who are they going to support?
Malcolm.
That's Sean.
Malcolm.
Yes, Malcolm, correct. What castle does Macbeth fortify? That's Villa.
Dunsinane.
Dunsinane. How many soldiers are coming? Sean.
10,000.
10,000 is correct. Hew down a bough and bear it before him. Why does Malcolm tell this to his soldiers? Yes, Sean.
So that he may cover the numbers of soldiers, conceal the numbers.
To shadow the number of soldiers, yes, that's well done. When looking towards Burnham, what does the servant say he saw? Sean again.
He saw the forest move.
Yes, correct. Who's the first soldier that Macbeth kills?
Young Seward.
Young Seward, that was Villa, yes, well done. What does Macduff say he will write about Macbeth painted upon a pole? And that's Kira. If you push the buzzer, you've got to know the answer.
It's the pass.
Time out. Here may you see the tyrant.
Yeah.
What does Macduff reveal to Macbeth when they meet in battle? And that's Sean.
That he was not of woman born.
That's right. Do you know what he says?
I was from my mother's womb entirely ripped.
Well done. Yes, well-deserved point. When Macbeth presents himself to Malcolm and Dunsinane after the battle, what does he present him with?
The title of a king.
No, something infinitely less pleasant. Villa.
The head of Macbeth.
The head of Macbeth. Well done. So, at the end of that particular quiz, the results are as follows. St. McCartan's, 4 points. St. Louis, 5 points. Collegiate, 9 points. And Patrician, 12 points. I think my favourite speech in the play is probably not the dagger speech, but she should have died hereafter, tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. It's a speech of a man who's just reached the end of his tether, that he's got to the point when I am too tired. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time, and all our yesterdays have lighted fools the weight. Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow, poor play. It's just a speech of tiredness. I've done all this, and what do I end up? Tired. I have a load of favourite scenes in this play. It's actually riddled with them. I think the moment when Macbeth returns after the murder is absolute classic Shakespeare. That he walks in, he's carrying these daggers, his hands are covered in blood, and he and the lady share lines between them that are all to do with fear and tension. He comes in and says these five words, "I have done the deed." He can't even bring himself to say, "I've done the murder." It's as though they're pretending it didn't happen for a moment. And then he sees his own hands and is horrified at what he sees. It's a beautifully written scene, and it's between a man and a woman who love one another and have done something unspeakably dreadful for each other. My favourite character in the play has to be Macbeth. He's so human. He's so much of a man put into a position where all his ambition and greed and desires and wishes can come true. Anybody who is put into a position where by some magic or other you're told whatever you want you can do, or nobody can kill you. You've got carte blanche to do anything, and we all think, oh God, that'd be wonderful, we can do so many good things, and you end up becoming corrupt. He is an everyman character who is promised invulnerability and doesn't realize that there is a cost to pay. He's very, very human. Our production crew today was Kevin Reynolds, Catherine Brennan, Sean Rocks, and Orla Cotter, with Tony Lyons on sound. Thank you to the students and teachers of St. Louis Secondary School, Carrickmacross, Monaghan Collegiate College, the Patrician High School in Carrickmacross, and St. McCartan's College in Monaghan. And I'm Alan Stanford of Second Age Data Company.